So how could you say you didn't see it? Me feel like shit. No coincidence that I feel insignificant. I'll take any amount. I need your touch. You won't give it.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Peace. Trying to understand the stuff of the universe is a big theme this week, with astronomy and with a proposed atom smasher which will reveal things normal colliders can't access.
It can also tell us if, let me try and call it, that level of Higgsiness that pervades the whole universe will stay at the same level forever, or if it might suddenly change through some quantum mechanical tunneling. And with it, all of the particles in the universe would change.
And we take a peek at the strange diet of some sea spiders that like to hang around methane seeps in the ocean depths.
These little sea spiders actually have a very reduced abdomen, and they are mostly all legs. And what's very interesting about that is that there's no place to put their internal organs. So their reproductive system and their digestive system, their stomach, goes into their legs.
The idea that most of the universe is made up of stuff we don't know about really should be familiar to any of you regular listeners now. Stuff like dark energy, whatever that is, 70%. Dark matter, 25%. And that leaves just 5% for the atoms you, I, the planets, the stars, cheeseburgers are made of. But maybe even I wasn't paying attention when the astronomers said, we can only see half of that. None of us wants to go to the grocers and be told, I know it looks like half a kilo of potatoes, but honestly, there is actually a whole kilo there. Well, this week, the shortfall in normal baryonic matter, as the physicists call it, has been made up by two teams independently. First, by using unpredictable flashes of radio activity called fast radio bursts that are themselves a pretty mysterious thing, but interesting enough for astronomers to have built a dedicated radio telescope array to study their behaviour. And here's radio astronomer Liam Connor, who's been using those radio flashes as beacons to reveal the missing matter.
Right, so these are little blips of radio waves. They're extremely bright. They come from vast distances, from cosmological distances. They seem to happen in just about every type of galaxy. And as you say, it's a big mystery as to where they come from or what physically produces them. It's not a total mystery. We've made some progress in the last few years. I think most of us would say they come from magnetars, which are highly magnetized neutron stars, kind of the ember that's left behind when you explode a massive star and you're not quite massive enough to form a black hole. You form a neutron star. Those things are very magnetized, violent, energetic, and we think they probably produce FRBs.
So it's some kind of, I don't know, stuff around them being whipped up by the magnetic fields and then it just snaps or something and that's when you get that burst of radio energy.
Like that, yeah. I suspect it's coming from what we call the magnetosphere, so very close to the neutron star. You have plasma being whipped around and then you have some very violent moment where you produce a millisecond of radio waves that can somehow travel for billions of years.
But it was worth building a specialized radio telescope array out in the California desert to look for these.
Absolutely. Actually, so the DSA 110, this is a Caltech-led project, and the observatory is the Caltech-run Owens Valley Radio Observatory. That telescope was built specifically for FRBs, which is actually not true of any other FRB-finding telescope previously. All the other ones were built for radio astronomy in general, and then they just happened to be good at finding fast radio bursts, but DSA 110 was really purpose-built.
But what's interesting is, if I've understood it right, that half of the array's business is to try and get as much understanding of these bursts themselves, about what's causing them, I guess, the sort of the dynamics that's going on. But you're also looking at the missing matter in the universe, and this bit really surprised me, so I need a bit of a tutorial. I know that only 5% of the universe is made up of the atoms like you and me and stars are made of. What I didn't know was that, in fact, we've only seen half of that so far. Explain it to me.
Yeah, that's right. So I think a lot of people who are kind of passively interested in space know about dark matter. They know about this mysterious substance that dominates the matter budget of the universe. Less well known is the remarkable, if embarrassing, fact that most of the normal matter, the stuff of atoms, which we call baryons, was also unobservable, was also missing. And this is the decades-old missing baryon problem. The reason it was unobservable is because most of it is very diffuse, very low density, it's very hot. It's ionized, which means the electron has been separated from the proton or the nucleus. So you can't observe it with a regular telescope. And then fast radio bursts come along, and they have this nice property that they're slowed down ever so slightly by the presence of this ionized normal matter.
You mean the signal as it sort of passes through gets sort of dragged on, as it were, by all this charged particles?
Exactly. It's like the pulse is trying to swim through a pool. And what's critical is that the slowdown is a function of wavelength. So longer wavelengths, redder colors, travels a little bit more slowly than shorter wavelengths or bluer colors. And this is a very small effect, but if you added it up over billions of years traveling through the universe, when it arrives at our telescope, we can actually measure this very precisely.
So it's almost like a change of the hue of that you're picking up. There's a slight tweak in the color, as it were, of these radio waves.
Exactly.
And when you're, from the way you're saying it, if it depends on the distance, then if you're seeing further away ones, then you're getting a different effect from the nearby closer ones.
That's exactly right. And this is what we find. So if you look at a source that's 3 billion instead of 1 billion light years away, then it'll probably have about three times more of this dispersion delay. So this effect is about three times bigger. And this is where the information lies, the cosmological information.
And it's accurate? I mean, you think you found the stuff that everyone else has missed?
Yeah, that's right. So actually, the very first paper on fast radio bursts was published in 2007. It was a single event. We call it the Lorimer burst. And the final sentence of that paper says something like, you know, if we could just pinpoint the distance to the host galaxy and collect a large sample of these things, they would be really useful for going after the missing normal matter in the universe. I'm paraphrasing, but this is the sentiment. Now in 2024, 2025, we finally have a large enough sample of fast radio bursts to do this. So it's really fun. I mean, this was predicted in the very first FRB paper.
And you really have, you know, the stuff that we don't know about shows up in your survey in the amount that you'd expect.
Absolutely, yeah. There's really good agreement with the total predicted amount of ordinary matter. And this prediction comes from early universe measurements. So you might have heard of the cosmic microwave background radiation. This is light left over from the Big Bang. And fluctuations in that light tell us about all the stuff that was around about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. So you have this like census very early on. And then if you go and you try to count up all the stuff you think there should be, you come up short until we have the sample of FRBs, basically.
Yeah, that must be pretty satisfying.
It is, yeah. Sometimes it's nice to have concordance. Sometimes it's nice to not be in crisis. Like, there's a lot of very interesting things that came out of this study. Some were a little bit surprising, but basically everything kind of makes sense, which is satisfying.
Do you know where it is? I mean, I guess that it's, like you say, the radio signal's coming through this stuff. It's getting a bit distorted as it picks up. Are you able to tell, is it just everywhere? Or, you know, maybe there are tubes of it or, you know, chunks of it some places.
Yeah, so I would say the key physical result in our paper is that the so-called missing baryons, the missing normal matter, is not in galaxies. It's not in the halos of galaxy clusters. It really is in this very diffuse, wispy, web-like structure that we call the intergalactic medium. So it's been blown out by all the violent processes that happen when you form a galaxy, spread out into the universe in the intergalactic medium. And this was interesting because this requires something we call feedback, which takes place when galaxies form.
Explain.
Yeah, so the reason we call it feedback is because if the universe were more boring, then the baryons, normal matter, would fall into galaxies due to gravity. It would cool down and you would form stars. And after a long time, maybe all of the baryons in the universe would be in stars. But what actually happens is you form stars. Some of them explode after 10 million years, the most massive ones. That ejects energy and matter outside of galaxies. You might have a supermassive black hole at the center of a galaxy, like the Milky Way does. That is very energetic. It's blowing gas around. And so if the temperature gets too hot, the galaxy kind of cools itself down by expelling a bunch of gas. And if things chill out for a little bit, then gas falls back in, you form more stars. That's why we call it feedback. It's kind of like a million light year thermostat, which maintains the temperature.
I mean, where the stuff is, I mean, the space even within our galaxy is pretty empty, but I presume these are just sort of actually an atom every, I don't know, is it every centimeter, every meter?
Yeah, something like an atom every cubic meter, I think. I did the comparison at one point with this sort of like the volume you would need for the air in your lungs to cover to match the density of the intergalactic medium. And I think it's like a solar system or something crazy. Very low density gas. So you can see why this stuff was very hard to measure in the past.
Is there anything more? I mean, that's amazing. Is there any more to be studied about it if it's got this interplay with galaxies?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the reason people are interested in this problem, the reason it's an interesting astrophysics problem and not just cartography, is because of this interplay with galaxy formation and galaxy evolution. The distribution of this normal matter, if we can really pin it down and make maps of it in the future, holds the key to a lot of major mysteries in the formation of galaxies, the formation of stars, the role of supermassive black holes. So it's physically very interesting. It's not just like, oh, shucks, I wish we knew where the baryons were.
Does that mean that, you know, like we're having with the James Webb Space Telescope, by seeing further back, if you could see further and further back, you might see some changes in what's going on between the galaxies, and that would help all that kind of cosmology?
Absolutely. I think so. We're building these much more sensitive telescopes in the future. I mentioned the DSA 110. We're also building, and it's also Caltech-led, the DSA 2000, which will be way more sensitive, and we expect to find fast radio bursts back to when the universe was a few hundred million years old. And as you say, if you have them from all the way from the local universe to the baby universe, you can map out the evolution of the sort of distribution of normal matter. And that will be really interesting.
It is. And it's, I suppose it's just, for me, it's just slightly mind-boggling. This goes back to what I was saying earlier, just the idea that the galaxies we see are so bright, and yet you're saying that half the matter of the universe, half of this normal matter of the universe, is just almost dark in all the space in between.
Yeah, it's actually more extreme than that, because if you just look at galaxies and you count up stars and planets and the cold gas that you can actually see with your telescopes, that's less than 10%. And then if you kind of stretch that and you say, well, I saw this galaxy cluster glowing in X-rays, so there's a little bit more there. Then you get up to 50%. So really, the stuff you think of when you think of normal, non-dark matter, people, planets, Pop-Tarts, whatever, that's a very, very small fraction of the baryons in the universe.
Liam Connor of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. His findings were detailed in Nature Astronomy earlier this week, to be followed just a few days later by a completely different approach using the unbelievably faint X-ray glow from within this diffuse gas to map some of it out. Again, I needed to catch up because I associate X-rays with violent, dense parts of the universe, not atoms or ions I imagine drifting through the emptiness of space. So Kostas Migas of Leiden University put me in the picture.
It's glowing because the particles there have a lot of kinetic energy, electrons, protons, and these particles interact with each other with something it's called free radiation or Bremsstrahlung radiation in astrophysics.
So they sort of almost collide. They go through exactly, glancing collisions.
Exactly. And they interact and the system loses energy. And this energy between an electron and the proton is emitting as an X-ray photon. And this X-ray photon travels through space for hundreds of millions of years to reach our telescopes here on Earth.
These collisions must be sort of individually so rare, because as I understand it, you have about, I don't know, something like one atom every cubic meter or something like that.
Yes, but they are not rare at all because their velocities are very, very high. So these interactions happen constantly all the time everywhere across the filament. And actually, it's the same mechanism that larger structures in the universe emit as well. For example, galaxy clusters.
But it's just a lot fainter.
Compared to galaxy clusters, yes, because the level of emission really depends on the density. The density in these filaments is roughly 100 times or 1,000 times lower than clusters of galaxies. This means that the X-ray signal is also much, much lower.
And so you've sort of chosen to look at a particularly dark part of the sky, is that right?
Yes, at the part that we suspected there might be such a filament of gas connecting these huge systems of galaxies at its end. So what we actually did, the difficulty and the limitation in these studies is that there are a lot of very brightly emitting black holes across and throughout the filament. And these black holes are so, so much brighter than the filament itself. It's like trying to look at the candle between, I don't know, 10 flashlights from a 100-meter distance. So the real challenge is to isolate the signal coming from the filament from the black hole signal. And we managed to do that for the first time so robustly. And we are quite proud about it, actually.
And you say that you're talking about superclusters. So this is the tough bit.
Yeah.
The stars are collected into galaxies like the Milky Way.
Exactly.
And then galaxies have close neighbors. And mm-hmm. in fact, those galaxies themselves, those close neighbors, sometimes make huge, great associations. Mm-hmm. And you're looking outside even those, is that right?
Exactly, yeah. So as stars do within galaxies, so galaxies do within clusters of galaxies. They group together, thousands of them, and they have a lot of hot gas as well, and they're quite bright. And we know from cosmological simulations, so computer simulations of the universe, that between these huge clusters of galaxies, there should be these long, elongated structures called filaments. And wherever we suspect there is such a filament, we just go there and look and try to pick up their signal.
And they're filaments like threads on a web that sort of yes. Join the corners.
Precisely, yes.
And for me, this is a really interesting thing about your paper. So when I was talking to Liam, I was talking about, as it were, the generality of mm-hmm. this matter being out there. But it's also the ability to map it and then say, OK, I can see how all this joins up with our theories of yes. the way that the universe evolved.
Well, exactly. So there is a cosmological question, let's say, a cosmological tension called the missing baryon tension, which says that we kind of know how much normal matter should be around us in the local universe, but we cannot detect it yet. We haven't detected it yet. So what, for example, the FRB study did very, very cleverly is to use a new method to say, okay, we know the matter is there. We actually pick up its effects in radio signals, but they cannot really precisely locate it and study their properties. So what we did with X-ray observations was to perform and apply this, we want to believe, clever approach and try to characterize the properties of this normal missing matter and say, you know what, cosmological simulations, the model of cosmology we have is actually correct. The missing matter is there, and it has the properties it should have, according to our models.
And I try to sort of grapple with the idea of the vastness of these filaments that you're talking about, because then you yeah. know, they're way bigger than a thread or a web.
Yes, yeah.
And the emptiness of the space between the atoms and so on. In a sense, they feel like they shouldn't be important to our exactly, theories of right? the universe. They, yeah. They're lonely little things just wandering, but you're saying they're actually a key part of it all.
Exactly, yeah. The one we study is 23 million light years long, and this is quite average, actually, in terms of size. There are filaments way larger, way longer than this one. And as you said in the beginning, the density seems so low, right? It's like 10 electrons every cubed meter or so, which is very, very low. But because of these huge kinetic energies they have and the huge speeds, velocities they have, they interact all the time, emitting X-ray photons all the time. And we have to become better and better in our observational methods to pick up these X-ray photons and try to understand our local universe in a much better and efficient way than we did before.
And, I mean, in a sense, I'm talking about this as if this was the end of a story, finding the missing matter, but I'm sure you think of this as the beginning of the next chapter.
Exactly, because we saw that the missing matter is there within a given supercluster. This is just one structure, right? There's a whole universe to go explore now that we have paved the way, let's say, to and showed how it people should go after these sources. But it still remains to go and perform the same study, the same observations in tens or even hundreds of such structures in different parts of the universe, and really verify that the model of cosmology we have is the correct one. But this is just the beginning, as you said, yeah.
A little goes a long, long way in the vastness of the cosmos. Cossus Miga's X-ray visions were just published in Astronomy and Astrophysics. We've put links for both of those studies on the Science in Action webpage at bbcworldservice.com. And talking of webs, we've spiders still to come, but sea spiders, so actually no webs to catch prey, but their diet is remarkable. But before that, we're sticking with understanding the stuff of the universe, though not with astronomy, rather with those other expensive pieces of kit, particle colliders. For decades, the US dominated the field with facilities like the Stanford Linear Accelerator, Brookhaven National Labs, Fermilab near Chicago, where quarks and other things were discovered and studied. More recently, the focus has turned to Europe's CERN, where they discovered the Higgs in the Large Hadron Collider, LHC, and before that, the weak force mechanisms in the Large Electron-Positron Collider, LEP. A report from the US National Academy of Sciences recommends the country regain some of the initiative by building its own collider 10 times as powerful as the LHC. And rather than banging protons or electrons together, they should collide muons, an altogether more exotic species. Tover Holmes of Tennessee University is an enthusiast for this challenging approach.
So far with our colliders, we have done what is very decidedly the logical thing to do. And we have taken the stable charged particles that are available to us in the universe and built colliders with them. So we have taken electrons, which are negatively charged, and taken their antiparticle positrons and collided those together. They annihilate, and you can make new things with all of the energy from that annihilation from E equals mc squared. Or you take something like protons, which aren't fundamental particles. They have quarks and gluons inside of them, but they're stable and they're charged, and you can collide them. The constituents inside of them actually make the collision, and they don't do simple annihilations. You get this whole mess of stuff that comes out of these proton collisions. So you'd think maybe we would just do electrons because it sounds simpler, but the nice thing about the protons is that because they're heavier, you can get them up to higher energies. And so a muon kind of combines both of those situations. It's a fundamental particle like the electron, but it's heavier like the proton, so you can get it going to higher energies. But it has a huge flaw that neither of those have, which is that it's not stable. So not only do you have to do this extremely fast before it disappears, you also have to produce them in enough quantities. They're not just lying around. At the LHC, we literally use a hydrogen bottle and we just grab protons out of it.
So you, with the protons or the electrons, you can just find them. They're around in nature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you say they're not stable, I think of these almost as being, little soap bubbles or little droplets. They just evaporate sort of before you've done anything with them. They don't even last a second.
That's right. They actually, on average, will last 2 millionths of a second if you put them in your hand.
So that doesn't sound like a very promising approach.
It's a rough starting point. But the kind of delightful thing that happens is that if you imagine, you know, your favorite sci-fi movie with an astronaut speeding off into space and not aging, this is the same thing that happens to the muons if you get them going fast enough. Time slows down for them, and they don't disappear as quickly. So the whole game is how quickly can you get them going up to those speeds so that you can extend their lifetime.
So a muon collider would start off with some kind of apparatus. I presume this is going to be something like a proton, you know, the kind of machine they have at CERN.
Yeah.
That makes these things as fast as possible.
Exactly.
You've got to catch them. Mm-hmm. Presumably when you make them, they're flying off in every direction.
Oh, yes. This is one of the biggest problems and the most unique problems of a muon collider. You have to wrangle them, and you have to wrangle them so fast. So this is what we call muon cooling. And this is something that a key element of this R&D that this National Academies report talks about is trying to demonstrate that it's possible to do this muon cooling. Because if you can't wrangle that beam fast enough to accelerate it, then you can't take advantage of that cool special relativity stuff and you can't make your collider.
Okay, so we'll assume you find the magic to do that. Then put them into, this would be a machine a bit like they have at CERN, is it a circular thing where you're firing them around in big loops in a tunnel? And they hit at the other side, and all the time you're stuffing more and more of these muons in at the back end.
Exactly. One kind of fun, well, I don't know if anyone cares, but one interesting feature that's a bit different from a proton collider is that you would actually have two rings. So you want to accelerate them as fast as possible, and that means filling your rings with magnets that can accelerate them. But then once they're up at that speed, you want to collide them as often as possible, which means it would be much better if you could shrink your ring and have more collisions per second as they go around. So you do a bigger accelerator ring and a smaller collider ring so you can get the most bang for your buck.
So it sounds like quite a lot of complex engineering. I went to CERN, and I believe you do quite a lot of work there yourself.
I do,
so
yes.
You know about this.
Yeah.
I went to CERN when they first announced this future circular collider program. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And their approach is you can do this thing with the known particles, the ready available particles. You just need to build an absolutely massive tunnel under the ground.
Yeah.
So it's a big engineering operation.
Absolutely.
What's the advantage of taking this route?
So the FCC project begins with a very low energy machine that they call a Higgs factory. So a Higgs factory is something that the particle physics community has been talking about for a long time. The essential idea is that, you know, we'd really like to study the Higgs. We understand that the Higgs is this unique ingredient in the particles that make up the universe, and it's the most recent one we've discovered, and so naturally we want to study it further. So the typical idea for a Higgs factory is this lower energy machine that just makes a Higgs boson. So it's lower energy even than the LHC, but you get this much higher number of Higgs bosons, and you can study it with more precision. So basically this Higgs factory makes them one after another. So it makes a Higgs, it decays, and you study it by measuring those decays. But if you can go to high enough energies, so much higher energies than we're talking about with something like an E plus E minus collider in a circular ring like the FCC one that they're just discussing, if you can go to higher energies, you can do something quite different, and you can make what I would call a multi-Higgs factory. So now you're making a few Higgs bosons at once. They interact, they decay, and you can learn about their interactions from the decays instead of just learning about a single particle. And it turns out that that behavior, the interactions, which is totally inaccessible at a traditional Higgs factory, that encodes the answers to some of the most interesting questions that study of the Higgs can reveal. My sort of short, glib description is that it tells us about the birth and the death of the universe. So what do I mean by that? I mean, it can tell us how when the universe was born, the Higgs acquired this unique property that it possesses, which is the fact that this field essentially pervades every corner of the universe and that the interactions of all of the other particles with that field is what gives them all of their mass. So basically, how Higgsy is the entire universe. So that property, you can study how that came to be in the early universe by studying the interactions of multiple Higgses. And it can also tell us if, let me try and call it that level of Higgsiness that pervades the whole universe will stay at the same level forever, or if it might suddenly change through some quantum mechanical tunneling. And with it, all of the particles in the universe would change, which I think we could safely call the death of the universe.
Okay. So it's quite interesting because these are actually quite big questions.
It sounds like...
It's not just a parallel route to what they're talking about at CERN. This is a very complementary, different sort of view of the universe.
Yes. So the Higgs factory that you could build with an E plus E minus huge circular collider that's talked about with the FCC couldn't study those questions. They talk about following up that collider by putting protons inside of that huge collider, and that could reach those same energies and potentially study some of those same questions. But that wouldn't happen until I think the current dates are something like the 2080s. So the muon collider could potentially reach that point a lot earlier and with a smaller footprint and so smaller cost, smaller environmental impact, smaller power consumption.
It's very interesting because the report says its recommendation one is the US should host the world's highest energy elementary particle collider around the middle of the century. So this is a very big ambition.
Yeah.
And the idea is this to try and maintain leadership in this kind of physics.
Yeah. And it's not as if the US is the only one interested. There's CERN hosts something called the International Muon Collider Collaboration, of which I'm also a part, which has been working towards a muon collider for a while and is very much part of this upcoming European strategy effort. So right now they're sort of getting ready for a big community meeting in Venice that happens next week, where they're going to discuss the possibilities of different colliders. And there are plenty of people in Europe who are also working on a muon collider and thinking about it for the CERN site. But there's a lot of possibility, I think, as well, for building it in the US at Fermilab.
To do what the Future Circular Collider is planning is basically doing the same again on a bigger scale. Mm-hmm. The technology that you have to develop to get to starting to build it, no one's going to pay for this until you can say, yeah, actually, it's going to cost a lot of money, but we can do it. What's the pathway there?
So the people who are working towards a muon collider want to build a demonstrator for this technology in the very near future. So right now we're working on designs for what we would call a demonstrator for this cooling channel, which is that main kind of unique item that's so essential for a muon collider, which is
that's the corralling them all at the beginning.
Exactly. So that is a much less expensive project, although it's not terribly cheap, but it's, you know, orders of magnitude cheaper than an actual muon collider. And that is, I think, the most urgent thing to do right now. And it's the thing that will decide if it's possible. Now, we do have designs that seem like it's reasonable. And there's an experiment, a collaboration that was called MICE, Muon Ionization Cooling Experiment, that was run out of the UK.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah, nice. And they were able to show that they could get what they expected with essentially one cooling cell. But you need to stack a whole bunch of these cooling cells on top of each other, and they get more complex to build as you go along this cooling chain. So you really want to demonstrate that you can actually build the cells that can accomplish that kind of performance as you go along. And so I would say that what the stage we're at with a muon collider is that we have a lot of engineering challenges in terms of how to actually execute some of the designs that are needed to make it happen. But we're past the sort of fundamental problems that physicists normally deal with when we're trying to decide if something could possibly work. So we're sort of at the stage where we're ready to decide if this is real technology that we can build today, and it looks quite hopeful.
And I did read somewhere, I don't know if this was your comment or someone else's, that one reason for going for a muon collider is because it requires new kinds of technologies and so on.
Absolutely.
That actually it will generate new industries along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. So I feel pretty strongly that the track record of particle physics, you know, I'll say frankly, obviously not everybody cares about the Higgs boson, even though I hope I made a compelling case with the whole birth and death of the universe thing. But not everybody does care about the Higgs boson. And our machines cost a lot of money. So it's really important that they give something back to society when they're created, that everybody agrees is something of value. And what we've done so far, so one example is when we built the Tevatron, which was the last highest energy collider in the US, they figured out how to make at industrial scale these huge superconducting magnets. And that technology and the systems that were used to create it directly resulted in the creation of all the magnets that go into MRIs today. And actually, medical imaging technology is littered with developments from particle physics. And so it's really when we try to do something new, in that case, it was trying to build superconducting magnets around a ring for the first time, that we do something that really creates impacts far beyond what we were trying to study in the first place and create all of that beautiful benefit to society that fundamental research does. Unfortunately, if you keep using the same strategy, you're a lot less likely to create something novel like that.
Tove Holmes on the payback from the gamble of smashing muons together. Finally, those spiders are species of sea spider which have taken to a kind of farming in the depths of the oceans where other meals are hard to come by. Farming bacteria on their body. like the intergalactic gas we were talking about earlier, these spiders are hard to see. All the more reason for marine biologist Shanna Goffredi to keep looking.
They're actually pretty hard to see on the seafloor. They are a little bit translucent. They're about a centimeter in leg span, and they blend in perfectly with their surroundings. They are skinny little things, and they are, that's one thing that makes them different from terrestrial spiders, is that we associate terrestrial spiders with having this very big abdomen where silk comes out of. These little sea spiders actually have a very reduced abdomen, and they are mostly all legs. And what's very interesting about that is that there's no place to put their internal organs. So their reproductive system and their digestive system, their stomach, goes into their legs.
Oh, which may come up, I guess, in this story then. where are they found?
So sea spiders are found throughout the world's oceans, but this particular group of sea spiders has only ever been observed at methane seeps and hydrothermal vents. So they have quite an affinity for very specialized habitats.
And these are on the seafloor. I mean, when you say observed, is this actually a question of going down in some kind of, you know, submarine or something to watch them at the bottom of the sea?
Yes. So we use either robotic submersibles or human-occupied submersibles to get down there. In this particular study, we were using a robotic submersible from the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute in 2021. And then in 2023, we got to use Alvin, the human-occupied vehicle.
And that was what, because you wanted to bring some back to the lab or what?
Oh, yes. So we had a hypothesis that these sea spiders from our initial collection in 2021, we were exploring the influence of methane in the deep sea. We had collected just a few of these sea spiders, but we brought them back to the lab. And we realized that their tissues had a signature of the incorporation of methane. We were able to then revisit these sites using the Alvin and actually conduct experiments that would either provide evidence or negate that hypothesis. And it turns out that we were right. So we were able to collect sea spiders and we were able to track methane molecules from outside of them through a bacterial community and then into their tissues. And that is the results that are the subject of the paper.
Ah, so it's not that they're inhaling the methane, they're getting help.
Oh, yes. So there are several animals known that can rely on methane as a source of carbon, but no animal on Earth can do it by themselves. So only bacteria and archaea, another single-celled organism group, can do that. And so they do have to have help. So whether they have a symbiont inside of their bodies or on the outside of their bodies, or they farm methane oxidizing bacteria like the ones we see with the spiders, they have to have a microbial partner.
So they've got bacteria on their, skin, on their cuticle, I guess is the right word.
That's a great word. Yes, exoskeleton we call it. But we think that they turn around and groom their body surface, or maybe they groom their neighbors, and they get a large portion of their nutrition from this source, which is basically bacteria living on their exoskeleton.
And you said that they have their stomach on their legs or in their legs. I mean, are they using their mouths to sort of eat the bacteria, or are chemicals sort of being absorbed through the surface or what?
Yes, they are using their mouths. So they are just like you would eat eggs for breakfast. They process them in the same way that you would expect a typical animal. So they will take it into a stomach and digest those bacteria.
And do you know if there's anything in it for the bacteria? I mean, do these spiders make a really good surface that means that they can multiply, I don't know, without being washed away or something?
Many of these bacteria in other animal microbe symbioses will attach themselves to a much larger animal so they can be moved around the ocean. So for instance, these bacteria need both methane and oxygen in order to oxidize that high energy methane molecule and then turn it into organic carbon. And so by associating with an animal that can lumber around and move you to different locations, this would actually be a benefit over a single-celled microbe floating around on the seafloor.
hitching a ride. It's amazing. Do you know how long this has been going on for?
So I do not know the answer to that question. I would say hundreds of millions of years, because the three species we discovered belong to a group of sea spiders that includes 11 species. So that group is probably fairly old, and they're all found at these habitats where chemicals are coming from below the surface of the planet.
I asked partly because about 25 years ago, almost actually exactly, we featured a similar story, but it was about trilobites from 500 million years ago that were cultivating bacteria. I guess bacteria, you know, got here first, and they're very good at fixing dinner for us if we give them the chance.
Oh, absolutely. Microbes have a whole array of metabolic possibilities. They can eat the craziest things, and in turn, they actually, you know, can complete a lot of chemical cycles on the planet. And they have been around for billions of years before any other organism got here. And so they've had a long time to practice a variety of different weird metabolisms. And I'm just really open to the possibilities that animals will amaze me at every turn, you know, and that is especially true in the deep sea. So we are almost always finding an animal that does something really strange in the deep sea.
Shana Goffredi of Occidental University in California, who seems to have a taste for weird marine diets. Whale bones is another food source that intrigues her. There's a link to her work and more on everything on the Science in Action webpage at bbcworldservice.com. RMP's the producer is Alex Mansfield, who'll be busy cooking up next week's menu any moment.
Don't you blame it on to make you feel small. Lavage your appearance and the clothes you wear. You call that justice, just isn't fair. I'm talking about the law and order. They don't do what they order. Law and order. There's no justice in none. I had a friend who was lifted by the law. Lifted and shifted and dumped on the floor. They treated him like dirt. Kicked him in the head and then happily fled. Spat in his face and pulled his hair. You call that justice, just isn't fair. I'm talking about the law and order. They don't do what they order. Law and order.
Colette, letter verzet, actie, typografie.